Observatory, straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right?
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Yeah, subconsciously mocks that lineage. But
so that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. After Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, was published in 2007, The New Yorker's Larissa McFarker wrote that Klein had become what Noam Chomsky was to an earlier generation on the left, the most visible and maybe the most influential thinker, someone who seems to tie it all together. In The Shock Doctrine, Klein argued that in capitalism, the most powerful people often take advantage of a crisis, whether natural or man-made, to force ever more stringent conditions on the vast majority of people. She's advanced that argument through a number of books, including her new one, The Battle for Paradise, which is about Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Naomi Klein spoke at the New Yorker Festival with staff writer Gia Tolentino a little less than a year into the Trump administration.
The concept behind the shock doctrine was that after a shock, this conservative wish list can move. People are primed to accept all of these ideas that would normally provoke resistance, but in the aftermath of a shock, don't. It goes both ways, right? There could be a shock doctrine on the left. We are in a time of crisis and shock in which we, I think, are looking for a big narrative. Mm-hmm. We're looking for that full, strong social justice, economic populism story. Yeah. I think there's
Trump, you know, when there is a Trump represents a crisis.
Right.
He's the embodiment of this crisis. I don't think he is the crisis exactly. He's a symptom of the crisis. When I was in England last week speaking at the Labour Party conference, I described him as being sort of analogous to the Fatberg, you know, because I wanted a local example. But I don't know if you know about the Fatberg, which
know
is
about
this.
The Fatberg.
So the Fatberg is this giant.
The thing in the subway.
In London sewers have this huge problem where everything sort of noxious has found it's all found at each other in the sewers of London. So we've got like cooking grease and baby wipes, and it's all just kind of congealed into this giant mass that is really hardened and they can't dislodge. And I think that that's very helpful in thinking about Trump. You know, it isn't just one thing. It's just like all the bad things, you know, and it's hard to dislodge, you know, so he is that crisis which, left to its own devices, will echo through geologic time. And so we have to react to this. And he can bring us together in that way because he's, you know, going after everybody and so much that we cherish. But we do need a common story. And, you know, I tried to give some examples of people trying to do that. The Movement for Black Lives, I think, has gone furthest in this country of mapping the vision for Black Lives, the affirmative, which is not just, you know, it is cops don't shoot black people in the streets, but it goes well beyond that into reparations, ending mass incarceration, ending police militarization. But I mean, more than that, I mean, it gets into tax code reform. I mean, it is the world after the end of white supremacy that they're mapping. And I think that's really been missing from movements because of the war on the imagination that is part of organizing in this rubble. But I think it's changing among young people who didn't get the ideological hard sell that my generation got, and so are able to imagine something beyond capitalism. And so if you look at the trajectory from, say, Occupy Wall Street in this city, where it was like, that was the no, like the very loud no, but when it came to what the yes was, what the alternative was, I think it was still in a moment of hesitancy, of like, well, of an sort of an unwillingness to say, this is actually what we want instead, this is the plan. But a lot of the young people who were part of that movement went on to work for Bernie Sanders, you know, in the UK are powering Jeremy Corbyn's campaign, you know, in Spain are part of Podemos, which also came out of that post-2008 financial crisis mass movement of that at first was just the no, and then kind of hit the limits of just saying no, and then started to articulate that, you know, the yes, and started to engage with electoral politics. And that's a big shift for my generation, because I think we really were casualties of that war on the imagination, where we could reject, but we kind of froze up, you know, when it came to imagining a world that was really different.
There's a sort of pattern recognition that you have been setting out for people to hang on to. And I wonder, do you think it's going to take hold, the idea, the recognition that Trump is, he's part of a pattern, you know, like he's not unexpected. He's not, and I think the stylistic shock really gets in the way often.
The stylistic shock in the political sphere.
Yeah.
But I mean, but not in the cultural sphere.
Not in the entertainment.
You know,
sphere.
He's mass entertainment, you know. He's combining various forms of American mass entertainment and applying them to politics. I think Trump is incredibly predictable, like so predictable that if you wrote a novel predicting that Trump would be president, you know, like a sci-fi book 10 years ago and handed it in, your editor would be like, this is boring, it's so predictable, like this is bad fiction, you know? But so the disbelief is, I can't believe that these things that were in our culture and so powerful in our culture actually went to their logical conclusion. So why didn't we think that if we are in that category? And that's worth interrogating. I mean, one of the roads that led to Trump, I believe, is this incredible worship of billionaires in the culture and the outsourcing of so many of the problems that we used to believe that it was our duty to solve democratically in the public sphere, in the public square. And this idea took hold. And it was not conservatives that advanced this idea. I would argue that it was more aggressively advanced on the liberal side of the spectrum, that, you know, Bill Gates is going to solve hunger in Africa. Richard Branson has got climate change covered with, you know, Michael Bloomberg. And, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has got the schools taken care of with Gates, you know. And why? Like, why? What qualifies them for this? Their incredible wealth. That's what qualifies them. That is not so different from Donald Trump standing before the American people and saying, sure, I have no qualifications, but I'm incredibly rich. That was what he said, right? So how dare we be surprised? And how dare we look down on people who fell for that? You know, when the Clinton Global Initiative in this city, you know, held up a parade of billionaires and outsourced the world's problems as if it was some grand telethon. And so... You know, I really think there has to be a reckoning with the roads that led to Trump on the liberal side of the spectrum, because if there isn't, we are not going to get at these root causes. And, you know, I really fear that we are not going to present a genuine alternative that is captivating enough to win an election against him, which really, really matters.
Right. I think one of the harshest sort of truths to come out of this election was that, I mean, it turns out love doesn't trump hate, right? And you write in the book that, you know, love, you need something more than love. You need justice, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, and there is a part where you wrote, the choice that may at first seem radical, maybe even a little risky, may well be the more pragmatic one in this volatile area. And from the perspective of our warming planet, it's worth remembering that radical political and economic change is our only hope of avoiding radical change to our physical world. There's the risky thing, maybe the safest bet.
Or like what we have been trained to think of as safe, as pragmatic, is actually very risky if it doesn't work. Right? You know, I think Trump is very specific. I think there is a white lash going on. There is a response to, you know, this, he has to be understood, as Ta-Nehisi Coates has argued, you know, as a response to Obama. But I think there is also a risk of being too insular and too nationalist in analyzing Trump. I mean, this is a global phenomenon.
Right.
It is worth looking at the commonalities between the conditions that created Trump and that, you know, have created Brexit and you know, what's happening in France and Germany, India as well,
right.
Philippines as well.
You wrote, in an age of ever-widening income inequality, a significant cohort of our elites are walling themselves off, not just physically, but also psychologically, mentally detaching themselves from the collective fate of the rest of humanity. This secessionism from the human species, if only in their minds, liberates them not only to shrug off the urgent need for climate action, but also to devise ever more predatory ways to profit from current and future disasters. And you connect the dots here to the only way to justify this is through these theories of racial inequality. Mm-hmm. You can't justify walling yourself off unless you truly believe that you're superior. And racism is an incredible way to entrench that sense of deservingness, that you deserve, that as long as you're safe, everyone's fine. And I wonder, and I mean, watching Puerto Rico, I mean, I did feel shocked watching Trump talk about it. You know, you always think you're unshockable now, but I mean, it was harrowing, and it was so blatant that, you know, this idea, you write, that the people being locked out of the global green zone deserve their fate in some way. And that was coming, it was breaching, like, sort of the semiotic surface of the way he talked about Puerto Rico. And I'm wondering kind of what you saw in this disaster and his response to it in reference to all this.
You know, in terms of this idea that they're going to be okay, I think we've spent a fair bit of time sort of parsing the various positions within the Trump administration, you know, the deniers, the outright deniers, versus Ivanka, who, you know, believes that climate change is real, or Rex Tillerson, you know, who also says it's real. To me, that's completely beside the point, because what they all agree on is that we shouldn't do anything about it. And certainly Rex Tillerson believes that, as former CEO of Exxon and somebody who worked there for 41 years. And he said this publicly, that yes, you know, when he first said that, yeah, admitted that climate change is real, he said humans can adapt. They'll move to where the food is, right? Humans have always adapted. And this, I think, ties in with, you do need those theories of racial superiority, and white supremacy, theories of racial hierarchy, you know, they've always emerged when they are needed, right? They've always been strongest when they're most needed. And so the whole sort of scientific racism and all of that bogus science emerged as a rationale for slavery and colonial land theft. You had to have a story that told you why these groups of people did not deserve either their freedom or their land. And we are now in a moment where huge numbers of people are on the move. And I do believe that we all know that there are going to be many, many more people on the move. And so the need for those theories, the market for those theories, is increasing. We have to understand that. And the people who are being impacted first and worst from climate change are some of the people with the smallest carbon footprints on the planet, right? So we need the need for those theories that rationalize that fortressing, you know, becomes more urgent. And I think this is part of the reason why we're seeing, you know, so much more overt racism in North America and Europe right now. It's one of the reasons.
You know, like Exxon had studied climate change, or, you know, like Exxon had adjusted plans to accommodate climate change while denying it in public. And Pence, right, was part of this working group post-Katrina that submitted this big wish list, right, that included, the greatest one was like more drilling in the Arctic as sort of like a solution for the hurricane.
Yeah, so, I mean, when I wrote The Shock Doctrine, the Shock Doctrine begins and ends with Hurricane Katrina. And when I was in New Orleans, the city was still partially underwater, and I was reporting on how all of these lobbyists were descending on Baton Rouge with their wish list. There was a Republican congressman named Richard Baker who very famously said, "We couldn't clean out the public housing, but God did." And in fact, I mean, this was much of the public housing in New Orleans was undamaged by the hurricane because it was on higher ground, but this was very desirable real estate, and much of it was destroyed. So 2 weeks after the levees broke, there was a meeting at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, and it was chaired by the Republican Study Group. And they came up with a list of what they called free market solutions for Hurricane Katrina and high gas prices. They just bundled in gas prices. I mean, you know, they're bundlers. They like bundling. And so they came up with 32 recommendations, starting with, you know, don't reopen the public schools, give parents vouchers, charter schools, get rid of the public housing, create a tax-free free enterprise zone, get rid of Davis-Bacon, which is the law that requires paying the prevailing wage for federal contracts. All of this is reemerging now, post-Harvey and post-Irma. But what's important to know is that the chair of that meeting was Mike Pence. He was at that time head of the Republican Study Group.
All of these figures that you've been writing about for so long, they're all in the administration. It's wild.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think is there's a great piece in the Times by Eric Lipton and a team of reporters who've really been keeping track of what Scott Pruitt's been doing at the EPA and also what's going on in the Department of the Interior. And you know, there is this narrative out there that Trump is incompetent and he's not getting anything done, right? And certainly on the legislative front, they have been stymied, and thank goodness for that. But the power of being boring in the Trump era is really something, right? Because the Trump show is addictive. You know, even those of us who are appalled by it are to some degree addicted by it. And, you know, a guy like Scott Pruitt, I mean, he's so dull, right? There's no way he can compete in the Trump show. And it's perfect for him. I mean, and so here we are claiming they're not getting anything done. And in the Times today, I just have a list of all of the incredible feats that he has managed. Now, he hasn't pulled off everything, but he has pulled off a whole lot. I mean, basically, the governing theme is, how can we make climate change worse? Like, how can we do more to accelerate climate change and also make sure that we're less prepared when it hits? So, you know, a tax on flood protection, getting rid of whatever measures have been in place to relocate people when they need to be relocated because their land has disappeared. The list is really, really quite harrowing and worth looking at. And I think we should be on guard of this narrative of incompetence, because I think when it comes to financial deregulation and what the Goldman Sachs team, which is quite large in the Trump administration, what they are quietly accomplishing and what Pruitt is quietly accomplishing is very, very significant. They are getting some court pushback, but they're also getting a hell of a lot done. And you know, they aren't discouraged. They're just coming at it from all ends.
You write that, you know, to admit that the climate crisis is real is to admit the end of the neoliberal project. And I think the same is true. I mean, to fully reckon with the Trump administration is arguably to reckon with the end of the neoliberal project. And I think that's a hard sell. I think that's, you know, that's
depends on your audience.
Well, right. But you know, I think it's an increasingly easy sell.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's a very easy sell. Mm-hmm. But it requires, I mean, neoliberalism is seductive because it has its cold pleasures. You know, it has mm-hmm. these cold market pleasures. The fantasy of endless growth without consequences is seductive for a reason, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and I
mm-hmm.
think you write that to reject climate change, which is ultimately to reject the ideologies that produce Trump, is to relinquish this idea of, you write, ever escalating creature comforts inside ever more isolated consumer cocoons. Yeah, never mind what the planet can take it or what actually leads to our deepest fulfillment. I mean, it's
right.
That's what's on the table, right? I mean,
I think most people aren't living that.
Yeah,
aren't living right. that dream, right? And so, you know, I think I used to think that the primary task was sort of trying to get environmentalists to care about poverty and austerity and all of these economic justice issues and social justice issues, and lots of environmentalists do, but there are also still a lot of environmentalists that are, you know, just kind of focused on protecting green spaces and polar bears and things like that, and that's all fine. But I actually think it's an easier lift
yeah.
to be speaking to the growing numbers of people who understand that they are getting screwed by this system,
yeah.
right? And Trump certainly tapped into that. But, you know, I think part of the challenge that the Democrats face is that they have not been able to tap into that, right? And that, there was a campaign of Trump saying all is hell and Clinton responding, you know, all is well, but we need some tweaks, right? This is an angry moment. And this economy is not serving the vast majority of people in this country and around the world. And they're looking for big change. And this is, you know, why the Labor Manifesto was such a game changer in that election, because it was solutions on the scale of the crises we face, right? And there's a relief in that. After so much sort of like kind of people being presented with huge challenges and huge crises and then just being like, change your light bulbs, drive a Prius, you know, and also the willingness to confront power, right? I mean, Corbyn's slogan was for the many, not the few. And I sort of feel like if that slogan ever came to the United States, it would be sort of like for the many. And then just leave out the part about, like, actually we need to get the money from somewhere.
Right.
Right?
And there is money for taking, yeah.
And, you know, it is an economic populism that I think, like, that's where I believe the future of progressive politics lies.
You talk in the book about killing your inner Trump. Mm. And I wonder if you could talk about that some more.
That's the self-help section of the book. It's fairly short. Well, it's just part of this idea of just trying to bridge this distancing that happens, right? I do think that he is this product of the culture we're all in, you know? And we're not all in the same parts of the culture, but we're all in it. I think he is the worst of us, not to say that we are all responsible for Trump. I don't think we're all responsible for Trump. But I do think that it's worth looking at, you know, our own fractured attention spans. And, you know, just this sort of like this idea of this president who just can't read, needs everything in a listicle, you know? As we try to get beyond Trump, I think it is worth thinking about, you know, what part of us is just a little bit Trumpish. But, you know, maybe just the way, is there a way that we treat people on social media that's a little bit Trumpish and the sort of the, you know, set to nuclear that he's always got? Or that waiting for the billionaire savior, you know, maybe Oprah will run, right? let's look within to find our inner Trump. Yeah. Slay your inner Trump.
And that part, especially, I thought, it's because so many of us function within systems that are constantly telling us that there are not enough resources for everyone to thrive. So we'd better elbow our way to the top, whatever the costs. And I think that the instinct, that kind of the fear instinct, that like the scarcity instinct is where that's where my inner Trump is.
Yeah. And where I feel it, I mean, I feel it on the attention span, you know. We now have the first fully commercialized brand as, you know, a president, and he has a family of sub-brands, right? He breeds brands, right? And just like thinking about the way that logic, how damaging it has proved to be. Mm-hmm. It's challenged me in my political work and being, you know, building a new organization to be more conscious about, you know, our own brand and how, you know, and as soon as you start an organization with a brand, you want to, you know, you want to protect it and you want people to use your brand, you know, and now it's like let it go. Doesn't matter what they call it, you know. It's the ideas. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
That was Naomi Klein talking to Gia Tolentino from the New Yorker Festival in 2017. Klein's book, The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalists, was just published in June. And that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour today. I hope you enjoyed the show. And while you're killing time until next week, please follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.